I was pretty much a loner at the age of 21, 22. When I entered the academy, it was as if I found a whole new world. I made the rank of sergeant. And at that point, my drinking had really developed into a big problem. The one thing I was not good at was realizing the help I needed myself. And I know for a fact that there are cops out there that have experienced exactly what I've experienced and don't understand why. And my oncologist said, well, cancer spread. The chemo is not working. So I said, okay, what do we do? He said, go live your best life. Now, what I heard was, you're going to die in 3 months.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host Bonnie Rumley. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Rob Rudowitz. He's a retired Hartford, Connecticut police officer. We'll talk about having a non-traditional police career, addictions, ACEs, which is adverse childhood experiences, depression, vicarious traumas, and I think we're going to talk about retirement as well. Remind you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Respond to Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc. and Responder TV, bbsradio.com, all the podcast platforms. And please go to our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with Rob after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job.
In this family, up to a quarter of 911 telecommunicators have symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis,
while responders are quietly suffering.
In this family, many struggle with job-related stress,
burnout, trauma, sleep disruptions, substance abuse,
and relationship problems.
In this family, we can help the helpers.
With vital information and resources,
resilience strategies,
and success stories of overcoming the obstacles.
In this family, no one is alone.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumley, LCSW, EMTB.
In this episode, we'd like to welcome Rob Rudowitz. He retired at the rank of captain from the Hartford, Connecticut Police Department after a successful 20-year career. He held a variety of traditional and non-traditional positions, including acting chief of police. His early experiences growing up in the city, combined with his police career, contributed to a long-term battle with addiction to alcohol, depression, and anxiety. He shares his struggles over the years, as well as his ultimate success in finding true recovery, honestly and openly, with us on this podcast. Rob, a warm welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Thank you, David. Thanks for having me. And Bonnie, thank you for the invite. It's really good to see you again. Bonnie and I go back a few years when I was still up in Connecticut, and I was connected to her trauma support group through my work with Aware Recovery Care in bringing first responders there. The realization I have now about sitting in on those groups, you know, my intentions, my reasons for going were to bring someone to get them the help that they needed. But, you know, as I sat there and I listened to some of the men, I was pretty amazed at how much vulnerability was expressed in those rooms. And that was something I struggled with for a long, long time. So I think that, you know, in a roundabout way, those visits opened doors for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's great to hear that. Obviously, we always aim to have an impact, and sometimes we don't always know the impact we have, right?
No.
But getting connected with you way back when was really important to Stacy and I, especially because we were in the infancy of the team and all the work that would become what it is today. So we're grateful to you for being on that journey with us in the beginning when we were just getting started out. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you, because it got me out of the office for a whole day.
Good. Well, I'd love to ask you, for our viewers, you know, I know a little bit more about you because we had that connection before, but I would love for the viewers and listeners to learn a little bit about you and what led you to police work in the beginning.
Well, it was really kind of a, I call it an accidental journey into police work. It was not anything that I aspired to. It was not anything that I, you know, sat down as a kid and dreamed of. Sure, I played cops and robbers and I played, you know, cowboys and army men and all that stuff as a little kid. But I didn't have a real desire to be a police officer. I just couldn't see myself doing that job. In my later years as an older teen or in my 20 something. But what led me there was I have an older brother, and that's all he thought about. Mm-hmm. You know, from his late teens into his early 20s, that was all that he thought about, was becoming a police officer, you know, with the things of Hill Street Blues you know, those, you know, 1970s cop shows, Serpico and those sorts of things. And that's all he talked about. He and I were a little bit different. And at that period of my life, I didn't really have any direction. I didn't have any goals. I didn't have any idea what I wanted to be when I grew up. So I followed him. I went into the Army for a few years, and when I got out, I applied to the Hartford Police Department. It was really the first application that I had submitted. I passed everything, and I was hired. And it changed my life in so many good ways.
I know we're going to fast forward later to the retirement piece of all this, but let's fill in the in-between. You're getting started in the Hartford Police Department and you're leaving to pursue other missions with your life. So in your bio, it mentions a non-traditional police career. What does that mean exactly? And how did you, what was the kind of the arc of your career starting from rookie to retirement?
Thanks. That's a great question. So when I started with the police department, I was 23 years old. I had a lot of friends from my neighborhood. I grew up in the city of Hartford. Mm-hmm. And some of my friends from the city ended up in, we all ended up in the same police academy. So, I mean, it was a time of my life where I was pretty much a loner at the age of 21, 22, 23. And when I entered the academy, it was as if I found a whole new world. And I kind of gained a stride Yeah, we were just having fun. You know, we graduate the academy, we go out on the streets. You're here, I'm a 23-year-old kid. I got a badge, I got a gun, and I got this newfound sense of purpose. I got this newfound sense of identity. And that was the big thing for me, having that sense of identity. So for the next 8, I think maybe 9 years, I was in patrol as patrol officer. Mm-hmm. And just having a ball. I really was having a ball for the most part. And I'll talk a little bit about the flip side to that. But we were having a lot of fun. In 90, I made the rank of sergeant. And at that point, my drinking had really developed into a big problem in the late 80s. And everybody knew it. I mean, it was pretty obvious, you know, the way I would show up for work and mm-hmm. the way, you know, my friends would end the night at, say, midnight, go home, and I would just continue, you know, throughout the night. So I ended up going into rehab because, you know, it was a way to get away. And my wife at the time said, you better do something or, you know, we're done. People at work were, you know, there were the whispers and those sorts of things. So I went into rehab. When I got out, the department was just starting to develop an EAP program. I was close with some of the executive board members on the union, and they approached me and they said, listen, we want this thing to take off. We want you to build it. You know, so, you know, of course, I just dove in. You know, I wanted to help. I wanted to share what I had been given at that time. I found this newfound level of sobriety I wanted to build that. So that's where my non-traditional piece kind of came in. And I was good at that. I was really good at being the EAP coordinator. I was really good at helping people. The one thing I was not good at was realizing the help I needed myself. And then that, again, followed me through the years.
Come on.
Check it.
That really segues, Rob, into the next thing that I wanted to ask you, which is that we know cumulative effects of stress impact us in our personal life, but on the job as well. How did that trauma, and please, as much as you're willing to share, how do you feel that impacted your career at that particular time?
Yeah, it's a real interesting question, and it's not anything I really thought about until I wrote my story in this book. And in reflecting for writing that story, for writing my story, my journey, I really had to think about how the job impacted me and how I impacted myself on that job. And you know, as a young boy, I never gave it a lot of conscious thought, because I never thought of the things that I experienced as a kid as traumatic, because I have friends that I watched recover from Sandy Hook. I have a friend who his first year on the job, he had his throat slit. I watched him recover from that trauma. I have a friend who in 1989, I was 2 weeks into my role as the EAP coordinator, and I got called to a police-involved shooting. Two cops had been shot. My friend had been shot in the belly, and I watched them recover from that trauma. So looking at the traumas I experienced as a kid, I couldn't wrap my brain around how it could be anything significant. And that's a trap. It's a trap to make those comparisons, because, you know, what I experienced was difficult. I minimized it. I didn't see it as anything significant, but I do now. So, you know, we talk about the ACEs, you know, the adverse childhood experiences, and I think there's 10 of them that are relatable. I experienced 7 of them between the ages of 8 and 11, sort of continuously. And that, you know, those ACEs, you know, the physical abuse, the neglect, sexual abuse, domestic violence, addiction, alcoholism, those kinds of things that I was exposed to. You know, when I went on the job and I would get called to a child abuse or a domestic violence or, you know, some kind of an assault or something, walking out of there feeling like, wow, why do I feel so depressed over this? Mm. Like I couldn't make the connection that my traumas were getting poked unbeknownst to me, you know, and I would walk out of there, and not understand why I was feeling the way I was feeling. So in that respect, you know, the depression and anxiety would just get triggered. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I grew up depressed as a young kid.
What you're describing is, it's so common you know, or we have a first responder, police officer in our office, and we say, you know, what, tell me about some of the traumas you've endured. Oh, I don't have any trauma. But then when you start talking about it, all of the things you mentioned come out. But obviously trauma therapists look at it through a trauma therapist lens, and we title it something. We see people that don't like that word trauma. They don't want anything to do with it. They don't want it identified with them. So I think it's such a common phenomenon that people are experiencing these feelings of anxiety, depression, being triggered, and they really don't have a conscious awareness that it's coming from something that's happened to them in the past.
Correct. And that, you know, that was part of the motivation when I thought about doing this, having this conversation. The sort of the motivator for me is that, you know, I'm not out here talking about what a wild and, you know, crazy police career I had. You know, I'm here because, you know, there are, and I know for a fact, just like you described, that there are cops out there that have experienced exactly what I've experienced and don't understand why. They don't understand why they're walking out of a call feeling depressed when it was just a routine, as we say it, domestic violence, or, you know, another kid got abused, another addict died, or another, you know, alcoholic was taken to the hospital. Those sorts of things that we have that trauma response that we don't realize is a trauma response.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
So Rob, can you make connect the dots between the calls? Well, let's go back between the childhood experiences, the calls where, as you said, they got poked or activated, and then where it led you after that in terms of, you know, seeking help with mental health or addiction.
Sure. When I was 12 years old is when I picked up my first drink. It was the very first time I got drunk, and I really liked it because I kept doing it. You know, I became a pretty regular user of substances from the age 12 on. You know, that was after, you know, between the ages of 8 and 10, experiencing a lot of trauma, childhood trauma. You know, I was pretty depressed, but I always put on a good face. And what I've come to understand is that, you know, that was my rage. But all that rage was turned inward because I didn't know how to express it. And I was afraid to be honest with you. So, you know, I would go on calls. I would go to work and just be severely depressed. In fact, I remember one time I was walking a beat and I had my head down. And I was just kind of looking at the ground, and I can remember how depressed I felt that day. And there was a little kid. He was probably about 10 or 12 years old. And he walked by me and he stopped in front of me and he said, "Hey, you're the police, man. Pick your head up." Like, just like that. And it was like, holy cow, you know? So I knew I had to put that game face on. So, you know, I would get out of work and I would have to drink. I would just have to drink because it would be so uncomfortable, and not understanding why I was so uncomfortable. But the kind of the catch is this, that if you know anything about alcoholism, if anybody knows anything about alcoholism, there's something called the phenomenon of craving. And once I put alcohol into my body, I can't stop drinking. It's just the body won't allow me to stop drinking. It's the allergy of the body, as we call it. And I would think about drinking, which is the obsession of the mind, right? Mm-hmm. Thinking about, I can't wait to get out of work so I can find that relief. And I'm only going to have 3 beers. I'm going to be home by midnight, you know. I just didn't know it was going to be midnight the next day, you know. And that was a reality, you know. I had friends that would joke with me and say, you know, I saw you at Chuck's Thursday night, and you were wearing the same clothes you have on now, and it's Saturday, you know, wow. Because that's where, you know, But you know, leaving work and you know, having to find that relief was just it was something I had no control over, as odd as that may sound.
If you can embrace the concept and the idea of gratitude, so many things will begin to unfold in front of you. So many doors will open, so many windows open, the sun will shine in. Gratitude is really the go-to for so many different things. And it's free, right? Like, we don't have to have a physical thing in our presence to be able to use that as a positive intervention. You just have to open your heart and your mind. And if you can share that gratitude with others, you'll be benefiting yourself, but at the same time, benefiting others in the process, right? And then the biggest piece of gratitude, which is probably the hardest, is to allow people to show gratitude towards you. And if you can just embrace that, open your heart and let it in. But what's so important is to remember, they are feeling good about themselves if you let that gratitude in.
Some people may consider it odd. Unfortunately, we hear it so much that it's our norm to hear that statement. And I know that back then the infrastructure didn't exist for help. You know, people didn't have necessarily the awareness that we do now in some of the departments and the infrastructure to get people help, like the peer support teams who are connected with AWARE and some of these other programs. So I could imagine it would be easier to go in such a long, deep black hole with no one there to really pull you out.
Well, back then, and I'm sure even to this day, you know, the solution is send somebody to detox. We're going to put them into a 28-day program. They're going to get educated. And then when they get out, they're left to their own devices.
Right.
There's no safety net, which is what, you know, which is the value in a program like AWARE, you know. And you know, I tried over the course of many years, you know, I tried therapy. I did the 12-step program thing. I tried the church. I tried going to the gym, and none of that had any kind of a lasting effect because I didn't want to make the changes I needed to make. You know, I didn't want to get honest and look at what was going on in my psyche and in my emotions and the necessary changes I needed to make. It was, well, if I do this, then I'll be okay. Well, if they would stop doing that, I would be okay. You know,
and was there a definitive like bottom point that, you know, you can point to that where things, you knew you had to make the change, and if you hit that, what worked for you?
Well, I had a few of them. I had a few of them over the course of 37 years, which is how long I've been in recovery. That doesn't mean that I've been sober continuously over those 37 years. So I've had multitude of bottoms, and here's the thing: there's always a trap door to the bottom. So you think you hit your bottom, there's another trap door that you could fall through if you don't take the necessary steps to improve your life, to make the changes, to get healthy. So I've had many of them. One such was when in 2000, when I was appointed acting chief. I had been sober for a number of years at that point. And I was appointed acting chief of police during a very tumultuous time in the police department. There were two grand juries going on. I was replacing an acting chief who was replacing a chief both of whom were out on stress-related disorders. So the cards were stacked against me. And you know, when I talk about the non-traditional career that I had, being placed into an acting chief's position created a lot of resentments around folks who, you know, had the traditional careers. You know, they worked the investigations, they worked the streets, they, you know, they did the grunt work, so to speak, while I was going to college. I was in, you know, I was in the administrative and that and those. So there were resentments that were created. So I had kind of a target on my back. And that generated a lot of fear in me. I was having regular panic attacks during that period. I really had a sense of not achieving what I've achieved in a legitimate way. So it's that sort of that imposter syndrome that we hear about. You know, I really felt that. So I had a lot going on. I was not adequately equipped to manage the stress that was involved in that position. Something happened and I had to I didn't have to retire, but I got into an accident. I falsified a report because I panicked. You know, everybody knew my history. And so the automatic assumption was he was drunk driving. And, you know, so I falsified a report. And that all came crashing down on me. It was humiliating. I was on the news for probably 2 days straight. I was in the newspaper for a week straight. I made the New York Times and CNN because Hartford is a capital city. Hartford had a lot going on that was making national news at that time. So here's one more bad thing about the police department that the media just, you know, they just grabbed hold of. It just created a whole new rabbit hole for me. And I went into that rabbit hole, ended up retiring after that. I'm feeling like I had a black cloud over me. So that was one really significant bottom that I had. Over the next 10 years, I bounced in and out of recovery. I would grab it. I couldn't grab it. I always had a good job. You know, as we say, I clean up nice. You know, I had a lot of friends. I had people that were, you know, backing me. I had people that had my back. I had people that were supporting me and wanting to see me do well. And time after time, I would find a way to sabotage the success that I was achieving after the job. I had many of them. And then there was one really significant one. And this is what changed my recovery. And this is what changed my whole perspective on what I need to do in order to stay sober, because, you know, I didn't always get in trouble when I was drinking, but anytime I got in trouble, I was drinking. Okay. So I had to finally look at that and put away that denial. Right. In 2019, am I talking too much here? In 2019.
No, this is great.
Yeah. In 2019, I was involved in a motorcycle accident. And it was September 29th, 2019. I was involved in a motorcycle accident. I was on 91, got cut off into the Jersey barrier, hit the highway. I was doing about 65, 70. I had no helmet on. I was wearing my leather, so that protected me. And I ended up with 7 broken ribs, broken collarbone, a lot of road rash. And I was in the hospital for a week. Well, while I was in the hospital, there was a doctor that came in and he said, you know, while you were in the trauma room in the ER, when you first got here, we noticed that there was something on your pancreas. So we're going to advise you to have that looked at. So I'm like, yeah, okay. So they're not making a big deal out of it. And they never alluded to anything. That's exactly what they told me. So, you know, when I got out of the hospital, went to my doctor and they set me up with other doctors and, you know, had more pictures taken and a biopsy and I was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And you know, you talk about a gut punch. It was kind of a gut punch, but it was almost as if when I was told that, I did not have a why me reaction. I had a why not me reaction because I knew I knew I had a lot of unhealthy periods in my life. So I'm like, well, why not me? Okay, what are we going to do, doc? What do we need to do? And my kids were there and my daughter said, is it curable? Eesh. And the doc said, no. And I said, okay, what are we going to do? He said, well, we're going to, you know, let's see what our surgical options are. And, you know, we're going to look at chemo. And so luckily they were able to surgically remove it from my pancreas, but it already metastasized to my liver. So that's where they were treating me with the chemo. So I started chemo. And then within 3 months, I had to go for another scan to see how effective things were going. That was in March of 2020, right at the beginning of COVID. Hmm. And so I went, had a scan, and my oncologist said, well, cancer spread. The chemo is not working. So I said, okay, what do we do? He said, go live your best life. Now, what I heard was, you're going to die in 3 months. That's what I heard. And I said, well, what does that mean? He said, well, just go live your best life. Go live your best life. But in the meantime, we're going to try some different things. And so my first question to the doctor was, and this is the absurdity. I said, well, would it be okay if I had a couple beers while I'm on that chemo? And he said, yeah, you can have a beer with dinner or something if you want. And so I left the office and I called my friend and I said, hey, guess what? The doctor said I could drink all I want. You know, so that was it was like, okay, it's going to be party time, you know? And so for the next 5 months, I was having a lot of fun. I'm not going to deny it. I met up with an old friend who is now my fiance, and you know, we became kind of drinking buddies, and we had a lot of fun, went traveling, and then in November of 2020, this is where, when I talk about that trap door, mm-hmm. you know, we think we have a bottom, but there's a new trap door. Well, we were out. And it was the Thanksgiving 3-day period, you know, day before Thanksgiving, day after. It was the day after Thanksgiving, and we went out drinking, and I got into an accident, and the accident was not my fault, right? Mm-hmm. But the DUI was my fault because I ended up with a DUI. Okay, so. That was a whole new trapdoor that I experienced. And I can remember waking up the next day. And I just thought to myself, okay, what have you not done over the past 34 years in your recovery that you need to maybe look at now?
Responder Resilience is your place for insightful discussions for emergency services professionals, including law enforcement, EMS, fire service, 911 telecommunicators, animal control, rescue squads, K-9 officers, corrections, trauma-informed therapists, and agency leaders. We bring you leading experts and influencers in emergency services, sharing knowledge and tools to improve the culture of wellness and to inspire excellence in leadership. Tune in live every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time for the weekly premiere on YouTube and Facebook. Or stream episodes anytime on ResponderTV.com or on your favorite podcast platform. Stay current with hot topics, informative content, and get valuable insights on how to lead a healthier life both on and off the job by subscribing to us on YouTube and Facebook. Responder Resilience is committed to our family of public safety professionals. Remember to like and subscribe today.
And so these new revelations kind of came to me, universe, God, whatever you want to call it. They came to me and I did those things that I hadn't done over the previous 34 years, which is connect with a 12-step program, connect with men who have been through what you're going through, who got through it, and who know what to do. But your role is to listen to them. Mm. You know, over the years where I talk about I was really good at helping others, you know, my philosophy was, here, take my advice because I'm not using it, so you might as well use it. Mm. You know, I don't need my advice. You need my advice, you know. And that perspective changed. I guess that's where my newfound freedom began. Mm. And I was able to get at the things that I didn't realize were just holding me in a dark hole.
Mm. Well, thank you for sharing that so eloquently. There's so much to that. And I think it's going to touch somebody who may need to hear your story.
I hope so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And speaking of your story, so you've contributed to a book called The Expand Man Chronicles.
Expanding Man.
Okay. Talk about that. What's your contribution to the book and where can people find it?
Well, so like I had mentioned earlier, I have a blog on Facebook. And if people want to connect with me on Facebook, I can then bring them into my blog. It's a private blog where I do a lot of writing. And I had a lot of people encouraging me, hey, listen, you need to write a book, you know. And I just, that's not what the purpose of my writing had been. You know, it was just to tell, stories about my experiences in life. And apparently, I don't know, I guess I touched a few people. And they put me in touch with this gentleman by the name of Ryan Hall, who is putting the Expanding Man Chronicles together. And it's a book of seven men who tell their stories about growth and transformation as men. So I started to write that and I started to write it from the perspective of kind of how the police department and becoming a cop had changed my perspective on manhood and masculinity and, you know, you know, all that stuff, you know, and I wanted to get into the whole, you know, toxic masculinity. But as I started to write, every time I started, I would think to myself, well, I've got to go back a little further and I've got to go back a little further. And I ended up going back to 8 years old, mm-hmm. you know, and then the story just kind of took off The realization I came to is, I think that whole toxic masculinity is just a media made up figure of speech. I do believe we have toxic emotions. Hmm. And I do believe that our traumas, our experiences can create those toxic emotions, which can create a person to be not who they intend to be. Mm-hmm. The book is on Amazon. That's probably the easiest place to find it. But if anyone wants to connect with me on LinkedIn as well, I do have in my bio a description of how or why I want to still help. I still want to give back. It's not anything I want to do for work. I'm not looking, you know, any money that I made off of this book, I donated to pancreatic cancer awareness. And so I'm not getting rich. I'm not going to buy a boat because I wrote a story, you know. I do want to give back.
Well, I read your story in that book, Rob, because you let me know about it, which I really appreciated. And it was so visceral. It was so poignant. It was so honest. And I honestly recommend that everyone read that book, especially Rob's story. I really loved how you described this monster gripping you and just taking a hold of you and battling it forever until you were able to win the battle. And I think that kind of imagery and that kind of description speaks to so many people, because everyone has monsters of different kinds.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I've really enjoyed reading it as a professional and also just as a human being. So it was wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. The name of my chapter is Detours Are Not Dead Ends. And because as I was writing the book, I saw very clearly all the detours that I hit along the way, but it didn't stop me, you know, I start off with talking about, you know, as a 8-year-old boy teaching myself how to ride a bike. And I finally conquered that. I had no one teaching me. I taught myself. And I was like, wow, I never really thought of it that way, which led me into, you know, all the other sort of detours. It's very healing. You know, we talk about something being cathartic, but, you know, it's very healing to, and I encourage men and anybody to sit down and write their story. Doesn't mean you got to publish it. Doesn't mean you got to put it out for public consumption. But when you look at the things that you've been through and what you've accomplished and what you've survived, you look and you sit back and you go, holy crap, I've been through a lot, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes we just don't stop and take, you know, step back or take a 30,000 mm-hmm. foot view of our life and our, you know, our journey as human mm-hmm. beings, as men, as first responders, whatever it is. And you've done that. And we're grateful to you for sharing that, your story, being so open and honest about it. And like I said before, I'm sure someone who needs to hear about it, it's going to touch them and it'll have that ripple effect. And we want to wish you all the best with your healing journey and all your service that you're doing by sharing your story, Rob.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't know if this would be possible, but it might be the easiest way is if you could put my email.
Yeah, we'll put it up.
And anybody, you know, wants to ask a question, reach out, make a whatever. I'm happy to receive that. And the email is my first initial last name at outlook.com.
Perfect. Yeah, we'll put them up. Rob, it's been a pleasure. The time flew by and we really enjoyed having this conversation with you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave. It was a pleasure meeting you. Bonnie, it was so wonderful to see you again. Give my best to Stacy.
I will. Thank you, my old friend.
Remember to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc. and Responder TV, PBSRadio.com, and all the podcast platforms. And check out our website, ResponderTV.com, for past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.